Morning, you guys. I don't know whether I'm going to be introduced or not. It's fine with me if I'm not. So I'll tell you just a few things about myself, and then we will begin. I believe this is the smallest group I have ever had in all the years I've been teaching here. So it will either be very fun or very boring. We'll see which way it goes. My name is Anna Otero. I am a law professor in Houston. I served as a judge at the City of Houston Municipal Courts for about 10 years. And I've been teaching for the center, I think, since 94 or 95. So it's been many years that I've been doing this. And I want to tell you as an introduction that I really particularly like teaching for the clerks because since it's such a small group, we'll talk a lot, we'll interact a lot. But I like teaching for the clerks because when I was a baby judge and I was an associate judge, I found that the clerks were probably one of the most helpful individuals in the courtroom for me. And so I really appreciate what you do. I really understand what you do, and I really do appreciate what you do in the courts. So I want to ask a question. Why are you in this section? I want to know why it is that, what it is that you think you can get from this section. So let's go through some of the stuff that I want to talk about, and then we'll sort of get your feedback. Since it's such a small group, I really can get a whole lot of information from you. I like to basically touch upon three areas: growing your career in the municipal courts, municipal court administration, the various employment opportunities, and of course that changes depending on the size of the court. To give you an example, I work for the City of Houston Municipal Courts. We have about 7,000 people entering the courthouse every day. And when we did arraignment dockets, I would have about 200 cases an hour. And so you would have courtrooms filled with over 200 people, sometimes 100. It varied, but huge, huge courtrooms. And the arraignments moved very fast until we transferred over to the paperless system. How many of you have paperless systems? Okay, is that working out for you guys? Yeah, for us it was a headache. It was really a nightmare because we had so many different documents that had to be transferred. And if you had a defendant with 5 or 6 violations, it took about 2 minutes for each one of them to show up in the screen. And quite frankly, I personally found it to be difficult. I left at that point, so maybe now it's really working. You're not completely, see, we were completely paperless. And so, you know, if you every violation, if you had deferred adjudication, it was a whole other set of screens. It took a long time, and I think for a city like Houston, it might not have been as effective at the beginning, but we'll talk a little bit about that. And then what I want to share with you is all the various educational opportunities that there are for individuals that are working in the court system. And there are many, and many different options that are available today. So I want to get a feel of where you're at, such a small group. How big is your court in terms of employees? Okay, so see, that's big. All right, where are you from?
Blue Ridge.
Is that around here? Okay, so one clerk, one judge. Okay, so that means you basically do it all. You do everything. So that's very different from a court like Houston, where we have, who knows, 1,000 employees, 1,000 clerks, and a variety of different positions within the clerical positions, administrative clerk, lead clerk, supervisory clerk. So, of course, that's very different. And, of course, in that scenario, you're going to have the clerks a lot more specialized in one area. So it's very possible that someone who works as a warrant clerk doesn't really know a whole lot about what goes on in the courtroom because they're in somewhere else completely. So that's a very different scenario. What about you?
We have 18 total. It's 11 clerks, 5 marshals, a judge, and
the... One judge?
One.
Wow, okay. So this is a full-time judge every day?
Every day. We talked about getting an associate judge for him, but it hasn't happened yet.
Okay, but 18 clerks, that's a lot.
It's 11 clerks total, but yeah. 18 people involved.
With the marshals and all that. All right, and where are you?
Abilene,
okay. Okay, so again, sort of a small court. So what I'm hearing from some of you is that there may not be a whole lot of room for mobility within that court system. Of course, we'll talk a little bit about other places. Yes, ma'am, where are you located and how many? All right, 12. Okay, so that's a good number. What about you? Okay, but the court clerk, I would assume, works full time.
Yeah, myself.
That's you. And so you handle window stuff like defensive driving and all these matters, and then you give them to the judge for them to fill out the judgments and all that. All right, ma'am, in the back. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay, that's a really big place. So where are you? Garland, okay. And Les? Yes, that's good.
One judge, one clerk.
One judge, one clerk. All right, well, let me begin by saying, I recently took a class in Houston. There's a place in Houston called the Jung Center, and named after Carl Jung. And it's a really wonderful place. They have adult educational classes, evening classes, workshops. And I do a lot of that because as a teacher, I think it enhances my teaching ability for my own students, plus I like doing it. And I recently took a class called The Navigations of a Woman's Life, and it was a very interesting class. It was a writing class. And what happened, there were about 15 or 18 women in the room, usually everybody about 35 and many of them over 60. And so we would get a prompt, things like, what have you outlived? And then we would write for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then everyone would have to say what they had written. At the beginning, a little bit intimidating if you haven't done that. But it was a very safe place, and what I got from that and what I want to share with you is the fact that, you know, a lot of these women wrote about the losses in their lives, husbands, children, illnesses, all kinds of different things that had happened, and what they wanted to outlive was the grieving period of all of that because they were through with all that. But at the end of the day, what I learned, and they were really very exciting stories, what I learned was that most of these women, no matter what age, and some of them were pretty elderly, had a lot of hope and a lot of optimism, and a lot of they were there, so clearly they were interested in life and pursuing other interests. And so that's how I approach this particular seminar. I approach it from the perspective that no matter where you are today, your life might change, and you may want to do different things. I mean, some of you are in the small courts, but you never know where you're going to end up, right? I mean, I went to school in New Jersey. I moved to Florida to practice law. Then I got married, and then I moved to Texas, a place I had never in my life dreamed of coming to. Never did I dream. The whole map of the United States, never did I think I would end up in Texas. And my husband was a very adventurous man and decided to move to Texas, and I just came. And then I've been here 21 years. So I never dreamed of being a judge. It happened. Never, ever. I mean, I didn't wake up one day and say, I really want to be a judge. Some of my students tell me that. I never did. I had no idea what it took to be a judge or what it would require. I did go to law school, and I practiced law, and that's what I was going to do for the rest of my life, and I ended up not doing most of that for the rest of my life. So I guess I approach that this class from that perspective. For those of you who are in a small court, you might think, well, where am I going to go? I mean, it's only me and the judge. But the reality is that there may be some other opportunities, maybe not so much today, but maybe 3 years from now, 5 years from now. We want to remember that municipal courts are criminal courts, and there are over 900 cities in Texas with municipal courts. So clearly, anywhere you go, you're going to have a municipal court. And you could always transfer to a JP court if you had to. If you went to a place that didn't have a municipal court, there's a JP court. Or there, if you want to stay in the system of courts, there's also county courts and district courts. So the criminal system affords you in Texas a whole lot of employment opportunities within the judicial system, if that's what you want to do. And if not, of course, you could always move out and go work with a defense attorney. That could always happen, too. So what I want to talk a little bit about is how do we approach making these changes? How do we approach looking at different possibilities within our own systems today or within other systems later on? Because for some of you, you are at the top of your game. So you really can't go anywhere. So let's talk a little bit about that. If you're going to grow your career in the municipal courts, that means that you're looking to upward mobility. It means that you want to go up from where you're at. And for some of you, by the way, this may even mean a judgeship. Where you guys are located, do you have to be a lawyer to be a judge? No. Not? What about you? No. Okay, well, that means that with the experience that you have as clerks, it's not impossible that one day you could actually aim. Because in Texas right now, JPs and municipal court judges and even county court judges, constitutional county court judges, do not have to be lawyers in some jurisdictions. They do in some. Where I practiced in Houston, you did have to be a lawyer to be a judge, but in some places you don't. How many of you would like to be a judge? How many of you are even thinking about it? Nobody's thinking about it. You're thinking about it. So I'm assuming that where you're at, you don't need to be a lawyer. So you want to be a judge because, tell me why you want to be a judge.
Well, I'm not sure the reason why. Because
I worked for a judge
who was having
strokes,
but we
felt
in
the rather sad situation when that happens. It's not the first time I've heard about that. I've heard of another situation like that, so that you're not even really aware that the person is beginning to really have issues, serious issues. All right, so because of that, you decided that you could probably just be as good as a judge because you were doing so much of it at that time? Yeah, and I agree with that, and I don't think you're disrespecting the judges. I think, for example, in big courthouses like Houston, where an associate judge works maybe once a week or once a month in some instances and some less than that, the reality is that the person who is there from 9 to 5 does have a better understanding and does remember things. And plus, let's remember that the legislature meets here every other year, and so when the rules change, some of the judges, I mean, they do learn, of course, they come here to this center and they learn about the new laws, but the reality is that if you're not a full-time judge, you know, you might forget some of that stuff between visits at the courthouse. Hopefully you don't, but it is a lot to remember. And yes, in my experience working as a judge, I did find that, you know, clerks were really up on the stuff and they really knew, and they very often could help me out with things that I had forgotten or I wasn't perhaps aware of as I should have been. So yes, I think you're right about that. So what does it really involve if you want to do some career management? And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I do think a global approach to moving up in your profession is important. So clearly understanding career development. That would mean that in the large courthouses, those of you who have 25 people, 18 people, you need to understand what the mobility track is. So if you are in the middle and you want to move up 3 or 4 positions, you need to know what that entails. Is that a possibility for those of you who have larger groups? I mean, can you move up? So, you know, there's job eligibility requirements that you need to know about, but more importantly, there are educational requirements that you need to know about. So when these jobs are posted or when these vacancies occur, if you're working towards those career goals, you need to have known ahead of time where you want to go, because education may play a part. And of course, the more education you have, the better off you will be in terms of being eligible. So that also has to do with identifying a career path. What do you think I mean by conducting a realistic self-assessment? What do you think that means? Anybody? We can make it very informal. Last time I had like 100 people in the room, but here, you know, it's very small. What do you think that means?
I think sometimes you overestimate your abilities, and so just really look at yourself and say, okay, yeah, sure, I want to be this, but am I really there yet? You know, what do I have? What qualifications, what experience, what education do I have that makes me think that I'm here? So be real about it. Don't overestimate.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I think if you are looking, and everyone in this room can do something else with their lives if you choose to do that. It may be that you're completely happy, you don't want to do anything, you didn't want to go to Rules of the Road, you prefer to come here, but you really have no desire to go anywhere. And that's possible. But the beauty of this workshop is that it's for possibilities. I mean, you may not have any possibilities today, you may not want any, but who knows? You may meet someone, move out of where you're at, things change. And if we don't believe things change, what's that governor, South Carolina, that governor that was lost hiking? I'm always amazed about that. Having an affair, a whole new possibility for his life, probably out of a job would be one. But we change constantly. I mean, your friends change, you change, so we see it. So I think conducting a realistic self-assessment is good. How do we get there? What, besides looking at it realistically and thinking, what do I need to do? What else might you do to be able to really understand what you need to do? Besides just introspection. Go ahead. Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking about. I think you may want to talk to the people whose jobs you may want to take, or who may be saying to you, you know, I plan to get married, I plan to move on, or I'm going to leave to go somewhere else. You may want to sit down with those folks and say, well, what exactly do you do? What exactly is required? What skills would be the best skills for you to take? You know, I speak to a lot of students who are thinking of going to law school. I head this minority program that brings in students from college and which helps them to understand whether or not they want to go to law school at some point. And we're trying to engage a lot more minorities into law school, into the profession. And a lot of them, I ask them, what do you think would be the ideal class for you to take in college to go to law school? And invariably, they say political science, government, and the reality is that none of those classes are that useful, at least in my opinion. I think English is very useful. And so I think perhaps asking people who are, doing this the job every day, what you need to get there is probably a really good idea, because somebody may say to you, you know, in this job you need to talk to people all the time. So, you know, having good communication and oral skills is important. It also is very useful when you're interviewing to already have known what the job really requires from somebody who's been doing it, because the people who know the best are the people who do it all the time. So understanding where you want to go and how to get there clearly is very important, because if you don't have a plan, then if you don't know where you want to go, then you're not going to have a plan. Once you know that you want to get to the top, then that's going to put all sorts of things in perspective in terms of what educational needs do I have, what requirements do I have in terms of knowing people and networking at the courthouse and doing all kinds of things to get me there. And then marketing yourself. How do you market yourself? It's not that hard to do. We're not very good at it. The typical person is not really good at networking and marketing. At least that's my experience. And at the same time, I will tell you that it's people who network and who know how to market themselves who get pretty far. So how do you market yourself? How do you do that? Because you don't have a whole lot you can do, because it's you and the judge. But still, you know, there may be attorneys who come into your courthouse, and it may be that you're thinking of moving to another court. Were more people with another position. So how do you market yourself? What do you do? And you network, right? Whenever somebody, you never know. You never know who is going to be in front of you that you're talking to that's going to be the key person. I mean, you never know whether it's a recommendation. You know, I don't know in your courthouses, but at least where I was, we always had, you know, surveys, and people would fill out questionnaires about how your experience was at the courthouse. Well, we are the first level of the courthouse in Texas. You've heard this many, many times. It is very important for us to make a good impression, because most people will never hit any other courthouse, but they'll hit ours. I mean, everybody gets a traffic ticket at some point or some other issue that is municipal court related. And so you never know. If that person gives you a glowing recommendation that brings it to the attention of your supervisor, and then they begin to think of you in a different way. I mean, let's face it, working your best in every job is a very effective thing to do, no matter what that job is. So there's a whole lot that we can do in terms of introspection and planning if we're thinking of doing something else with our lives. Performance is key. Anybody here is a supervisor? I know some of you only have. Okay, so you're a supervisor.
Well, I have two jobs. I'm not only the clerk, but I'm also the city administrator.
Well, okay. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. How many employees do you have?
A total of five.
Five. Okay, so tell me how you think performance is key when you're thinking of raising someone or promoting someone. How is performance important to you? So caring about your job makes a big difference. Now, we deal with people every day. It can be frustrating at times, wouldn't you say? I mean, that's just the realistic aspect of working with lots of people every day. As a judge, at 9 o'clock at night on a Friday, I would have the show cause hearings. 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock on a Friday, we would have the show cause hearings. This is show cause for defensive driving, why I didn't take it, why I didn't do it. You know, the first time I was on the bench, I was a little lenient. The first person who came said, you know, I couldn't do it on time, I probably gave him an extension where perhaps I shouldn't have done that. But I quickly realized that everyone had an excuse right after that. And so it became very tiring to hear, and then of course you couldn't really give it to one and not the other. So I mean, you begin to develop a way of being a better judge. And so one of the things that I did after that, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, Friday was my night usually, I would say, unless you've been in a hospital for like the past 2 years or the past 6 months, don't even ask me. Don't even consider asking me for an extension. I mean, I began to create a pattern. But what I found was that at every arraignment docket, giving the same speech that went on for 5 minutes became a little boring, and being asked the same question 1,000 times a night became boring. So I had to be very conscious of the fact that the 900th person asking that question honestly needed an answer. So then, you know, you have to really think about that. So you've been saying it 900 times, but that person doesn't know. And so you have to become very calm, and you have to really give each person the service that they require. But it is frustrating when you're dealing with many people, when you're dealing with different languages, right? I don't know how many of you deal with very different languages. I happen to speak Spanish, which was very useful, because at a court docket in Houston at 10 o'clock at night, maybe 50 or 60%, if not more, were Hispanics who did not speak the language. And so that was tough because you had to speak the language and then say everything that you had just said in English in Spanish. So the point is, our jobs can be frustrating. We're not just in an office working with paperwork and reporting to just one person. We're dealing with a lot of people, many of whom are scared, many of whom are very frightened to be in the courthouse, many of whom have no idea. Now, you know it's in the back of the ticket, right? Don't your tickets explain everything? Do you think anybody reads any of that? No. Nobody reads anything. And even if I explain something to the first person, the three people behind me would ask the same thing that I just went through explaining. So we do have to have a lot of patience when working with a lot of people. So, you know, when talking about performance in the courthouse, it has to do with your ability to handle these situations, difficult situations, dealing with people who are frightened, who do not know the system, to whom these situations, I mean, to you they're everyday situations, but to them it's new and it could be costly. And it could affect all kinds of things in their lives, and so it's important. How else do we measure performance in the courthouse? Because that's really what we're talking about here. How else would your performance affect how people perceive you? What else is important regarding performance? You're a supervisor, too. So what kinds of things do you look for people you are either reprimanding or promoting or evaluating? And so you can apply that to yourselves, right? So if you're thinking of moving up, you can, for those of you who are already supervisors, you know what people look for. In a court scenario, you look for somebody who's the whole package, who can convey information clearly and accurately and with patience and courtesy, who doesn't get flustered easily, who can juggle a lot of things. I assume you're juggling a whole lot of things, correct? I mean, you're multitasking. And that's tough to do. Again, it's tough to do when we have a whole lot of people depending on us to multitask. So performance is key. If you're thinking of moving up that ladder of success, if there are other jobs that you want, you need to look at your own performance. And you need to see, as compared to that of others, where you stand. And there's certainly a lot of shifting that you can do. And it could go from changing the way you dress to taking classes. For example, some of my students, I'll just speak from my own experience, some of my students, when I give them writing assignments, they're not writing as well as they could. And so they need individual help in that area. And so there may be areas that you feel that you need individual help in, so you need to seek that help out because nowadays it's really not that hard to get it. So all of this is really important to think about in terms of mobility. We want to have a plan. We want to think of performance and how performance affects our possibility of getting to a different place. So really we want to look at three things: image, reputation, and brand. Image is what you project and what others see. And image, I think, is important, particularly in the courthouse and particularly if you want to move up. Now, I know that in small counties, you know, the standards might be a bit relaxed, but certainly a professional image for anybody who wants to move up that ladder. You know, they always say, dress not for the job you have, but the job you want. You've always heard that, right? I think it's true. I think you want someone who always looks the part, and that's you. If you know you're trying to get to a different level, if you know that you want to become a judge, then, of course, there's many things that you can do in terms of image. So let's look a little bit to all of this. Really, what is image? Anybody? Besides the PowerPoint, what do you think your image means to others? How do you project an image, and do you think people really look at that? Okay.
I also do clerk stuff.
Do you want to become a clerk?
I am a clerk.
Okay.
I started out as a clerk.
Okay.
A lot of times, the first person who comes, anyone come in our courtroom sees me.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't wear my badge a lot, but I do wear my suit shirt. How I act in front of that person
and I think that's very important. I think it's not only the image that you give them of yourself, but really we are, we were, at least I was, representative of the court itself, wasn't I? And so when they write a letter, they're really criticizing the whole system. If you're not good at what you do, if I wasn't good at what I did, if I lost my patience, which I really didn't, I worked very hard not to do that because it's not a good idea. Once I had a Republic of Texas member who called me a spick on the bench. And of course, when those things happen, nobody, you know, it's hard because it's an emotional, you know, criticism. But, you know, you could put them in jail, you could do all kinds of things, but short of someone being very disrespectful, and I'll tell you what, I did have a lot of defendants, not a lot, but I had some defendants who were very curt and nasty to my clerks. Do you all have that experience sometimes? Dealing with difficult people. I mean, remember, it's not a cruise, right? They're going to get a ticket. They have a ticket. They're already angry about it. And now if they have a fine on top of the ticket, or if they missed their extensions, or they missed all of their deadlines, now they have the fine and then they have the points. So it's not really a fun place in terms of the consequences to the defendant. But some of them can get a little nasty with the clerks, and I never really appreciated that because you guys have a lot on your plate. You guys have a lot to do, and I think that's hard. But I think even then, when you're dealing with somebody who is difficult, you can turn it around, and you can make that experience for you be a much better experience. It's just a matter of how you handle it. You always want to remember it's really not about you. It's about their issue. It's about their problem. And so I think people see that. I mean, if you have a clerk who's watching you deal with customers or our defendants in a manner that really reflects a very good professional image, I think that's going to help you. So I think that all of these things are important to keep in mind. It's, you know, sometimes we have an image of ourselves that is not the image that others are perceiving. Isn't that true? How does that happen? How does it happen that you feel that you have a certain look and a certain image and everybody else is seeing a totally different image? How does that happen?
I think that's kind of a discrimination because you want to see yourself as good and right and whatever, but that may not be the, you know.
There's this, and I think you're right, there's a program on TV called What Not to Wear. How many of you watch that program? Anybody? Okay, in What Not to Wear, I think the interesting thing about that program is that they pick people who are nominated because of the way they're dressed. And many of them are very professional people, right? They're in office. Some of them are attorneys. Some of them are all kinds of positions. But I think the theme throughout the program is that these individuals have not really seen themselves the way other people are seeing them. And many of them are in very professional positions, and yet they're wearing old, baggy, dirty clothes. They're not looking the part. And then when you see the makeover, right, when you see, and they don't really do any cosmetic surgery or anything. I'm talking about just changing your hair, changing the way you look, changing the clothes, changing the appearance. There is a huge difference. If you've never watched the show, it's not really, it's a silly show, but in the sense that you really see people change. Would you say that changing someone's hair, changing someone's clothing, changing their even their posture, would you say that that could have an impact on the way people perceive you? Huge impact. Huge impact. So I think that image is something that we can work on if you feel you need to work on that. Image is one of those things that we need to be mindful of if you want to move up in that ladder. And it is something that we can get feedback from others, and it is something that we ourselves can make shifts and change. Because sometimes we're very stuck in where we're at in our lives, and just a little bit of a shift will really help us get where we want to go. So it's really not only about looks, but I do think looks and image does play a part. Reputation, of course, is not really about image. Reputation is your behavior and the way people perceive you. Again, reputations, as I tell my students, you know, it takes you a long time to build your reputation. It can take a minute to lose your reputation. So I think that everybody understands what that means. And it does count, because how you are perceived by the people who may be promoting you or the people who may be interested in you, not necessarily a promotion within the courthouse, but somebody who's interested in what you do, and they may say, you know, I really like the way you work, and have you considered doing this, and I'd like to hire you. I mean, this happens all the time. So that is important. Notice that it says if there is a disconnect between what you would like to be known for and the perception of you in the organization, begin now to improve your reputation. What could that mean? How could there be a disconnect between the way you are perceived and the way you want to be perceived? How do we create that disconnect? Anybody?
It's just for me, being in a small town, because our court's fairly new, it hasn't been around very long, people just assume that we're out to make money. They just assume that we're out to get everybody. They don't really understand that our purpose for our court is compliance for code violations and things like that, not to create funds. So we have to work harder at being nice. I have to work harder at being nice. So when they come in, trying to explain things more thoroughly so they walk away having a different opinion when they walk in. It's just, I think the disconnect just comes from perception, just what they think without actually having any knowledge.
I think you're right. And do you think that it's possible that if you shift and you make some changes, for example, the skills that you have right now, do you think they're transferable to another job? Does anybody not agree with that? Whatever it is that you're very good at now will be very good at something else. So if you're thinking of moving up that ladder, it may be just a matter of tweaking some of the stuff, and some of it may be educational. You may need some more education to get where you want to be, but the more you know and the more information you have and the better you express it. You know, a lot of people do not like to speak in public. I'm somebody who doesn't like to speak in public. I do it because I teach, and that's what I do, and I really do like teaching. And so when I teach my large classes, I don't even think about teaching, speaking in public. But you do know that if you are somebody whose job, whose new job is going to require for you to make presentations, for example, to commissioner's court or city council or the mayor, which some of our jobs did when I was at the courthouse, because I worked in the judicial department before I became a judge. And so part of what I had to do was every year, the budget presentation, I had to go before city council, pretty big city council, and make presentations. Back then, we didn't have PowerPoint, which makes things a lot easier. We didn't have any of that. So you just have to stand there and try to capture their attention. I didn't really enjoy doing it, but I had to. So you know there are public speaking classes, right? There's all kinds of things that you can do in your own towns to improve the skills that you feel you may need to get where you need to get. And I think when we see someone who is a good speaker, we're always impressed by that. We always envy them a little bit, and we go like, well, I wish I could do that. Point is, you can. And you might be much better than you think you are. And it may be that your job requires that, and somebody seeing you do that would maybe perhaps influence them in thinking, boy, that's somebody that we really need to have. All right. Also, the brand, and this is a total package. This is really everything. This encompasses your character, your education, your knowledge, your experiences with other jobs, your competencies, your values, morals, and this is individual to each one of you. Because each one of you has a different educational background, each one of you has a different set of skills that you bring to the job, some of which might be very important in one job and not so much in another. Language skills, communication skills, writing skills, all different things that each one of you has. So basically, this is a very personal thing to each one of you. And of course, unless I knew each one of you, I wouldn't know. But you guys know, because those of you who are supervisors, you are evaluating someone's brand, if you will. You're evaluating their performance, which encompasses a lot of this, encompasses how they perform the job, which is rooted on their education, on their experiences. I mean, don't you agree? All the experiences that you have today, working with lots of people in difficult situations, is a very good experience, a very good training ground to do something else later on. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but I wanted to just give you a global idea of having a conscious plan about moving up and really thinking about all these things, not just saying, oh, I want that job, but really thinking, what does it entail and what do I need to do to get it? So very quickly, ask yourself, if you're thinking of moving, which I assume because you're in this room that you are, where do I want to go? What goals do I have, professional and personal? What are my short-term and long-term goals? What skills do you wish to acquire? Because it may be that to get where you need to go, you need to have some more skills. And so, for example, if you're thinking of becoming a judge, it wouldn't be a bad idea to get some maybe legal education. It doesn't necessarily have to be a law degree because you may not need one, but maybe a paralegal degree. Maybe, I mean, we'll talk about that. What are the goals of others in your life? Why is that important? When you're thinking of where do I want to go, why is it important to think? And again, I'm just laying out for you a plan to really consider it. You've got the PowerPoint, so we don't have to spend a lot of time. Why is the goals of others in your life important? Yeah, so if you're married, if you have children, if you have a partner who is now working, trying to retire, and you have to support him or her, I mean, these things are important. You can't, none of us, except maybe that South Carolina governor can just take off, and there's consequences, right? I mean, there's consequences to what we do. So most of us cannot simply say, you know what, I'm just going to go to Italy and try to work there, or I'm going to move to Houston. You know, you have children who are in school. I mean, all of you, you know, look like you might be at an age where maybe you have some engagements in your life. You might not. Now, if you're completely alone, then nobody's goals are going to affect you. That's great, because then you really can think of all kinds of things you want to do with your life. And I hope you're not complacent, because what I learned from that class I told you at the beginning was that, you know, complacency never works. I mean, we can always do something until our dying end. There's always something that we can do to improve our lives, whether it's a new book or going to a class. There's all kinds of exciting things that we can do. How many of you have friends that don't really think that way and sit at home all the time just watching TV and let life pass them by? I think we all do. I think we all have those friends. Well, I would suggest you don't be that. Don't be that friend. Because life is exciting. And, you know, it's not over until it's over. And I will continue going to school and taking these funky classes until I can no longer hear or can no longer see, and then I'll listen to books on tape. Point is, you could always do something with your life. It's people who are complacent that enter their older years very bitter and angry, and we don't want to do that. All right, what are the expectations? So if you know where you want to go, if you've already determined your professional goals and they're realistic and you can get there, what is expected of you? Is it performance? Do I need to change performance? Do I need network from people to tell me what I need to do? Do I need to market myself differently? Is it the image? Is it the exposure? I mean, you know, exposure is important. If you are constantly going before city council or commissioners' courts, you're meeting a lot of people, and if you're making presentations, people are watching you, and believe me, it does have an effect. Is it sacrifice? I think most of what we do is a sacrifice. Wouldn't you agree? I don't think kids today, and I don't know how many of you have kids who are teenagers, but I teach kids that are real young, these college kids that I had in my class. Some of them are like 17, 18. I don't think that kids today really understand the sacrifice, because I think that maybe we've given them too much. I don't know. Maybe you may disagree with me, but I work with very young generations all the time, and what I see is a sense of entitlement. That maybe your generation didn't have. Certainly mine didn't have it. I mean, I had to work for everything I have, and I still do. But I think sacrifice is a component, because to get where you want to go, you're either going to have to go to night school, which is a sacrifice. I taught paralegal school at night. I love teaching it, but my poor students, they would get there at 6, from 6 to 10. And these were all full-time students. Not full-time, they were workers, and then they would come to school part-time. But going to school 6 to 10, 4 days a week is difficult to do. And I would have to think of everything in my power to keep them awake, because I taught from 6 to 10. That's a lot of time. And it was hard to do, especially when you're lecturing adults who are tired and bored. And so if you're boring, I mean, you lose a class. So it is a sacrifice. So I guarantee you that if you want to do something in your life, it's going to be a bit of a sacrifice. But if you really keep thinking in the end, right, if you keep thinking of where you want to be, all right, how am I going to get there? Well, performance, we already talked about that image. Actions and behaviors, you do have to develop a plan. It's all in your outline, so I don't really want to waste a lot of time talking about it. The point that I want you to get from the PowerPoint presentation is that it does have to be a plan. If you really want to get somewhere, if you really want to do something different, very seldom does it just fall on your lap. It does happen once in a while, but very seldom does that happen. Generally, you do have to think about it. Education may be something you need to do, and you may have to make some changes, and then executing the plan is always fun, but it does require some work. All right, any questions, any comments, anything? Sort of great to teach to a small group. I have 103 students, or I just did my last semester, 9 a.m. class, 103 students. You know how hard that is to do? How hard it is to talk to 103 students, most of whom are tired and bored. So short of getting on top of a table and dancing, I don't know what else to do, but it's tough to do. So a small group is wonderful. All right, let's talk a little bit about the employment opportunities. Now, this is going to vary for all of you. I just want you to be aware of the fact that, and I'm sure you do this, you know this already, that there are a lot of opportunities by virtue of being in the municipal court system. And that is because there are so many of them. There are so many municipal courts in the state of Texas. So many cities have municipal courts, and some of the large cities have pretty large municipal courts. For example, where I worked, we actually housed in the municipal court building the judicial department, which was made up, I don't know now, but we had about 55 judges by the time I left. That's a lot, don't you think? So the judicial department alone had a lot of staff because we had to work with 55 judges and cater to their needs. It had nothing to do with the clerical area. That was a totally different area. And so a lot of judges, we have, I think, 6 or 7 jury courts on a daily basis. 6 or 7 jury courts. Then we had satellite courts throughout the city of Houston. That's a monster of a city, of a municipal court. So if you're going to Houston, some of you may be thinking of going to Houston, well, there's all kinds of possibilities there. And certainly the job that you bring, in fact, one of the person who became the clerk of the court for our city was somebody who had been the clerk of the court in Corpus. And so apparently she networked and she went from Corpus to city of Houston, and that's a huge jump because now you're supervising thousands of employees. And so people do move from court to court. We see that all the time. Prosecution department, you guys probably, small courts, you have one prosecutor. Well, we have, I guess, I don't know the number right now, but off the top of my head, when I was there, we probably had anywhere from 20 to 25 prosecutors working in the courthouse themselves. They had their own department. So that was another possibility. We had some clerks that went from working in the clerk's office to going to the judicial division, which is a totally different division, because they had either gone to paralegal school or they had taken some criminal justice degrees, and now they were qualified to work in the judicial, in some jobs in the judicial division. We even had an individual in my lifetime at the courthouse who began, right out of high school, he began working at the City of Houston Municipal Courts. He went to law school part-time while in the courthouse. He became a prosecutor, he then became a judge, and he then became the clerk of the court. So notice, in a lifespan of about 20 years in the court system, how much he did. He retired, I think he was maybe 45 when he retired. Still retired very young, if you ask me. So it's completely possible to go very high, beginning just coming out of high school, having just a high school degree, going through college and law school, and then doing all these different things. So if you have these possibilities, and like I said, we may not have them today, but we could have them at another point in our lives, and that's the way we want to look at this. The career path, again, changes. Those of you who have 18, I know you may not, well, you already have, you're already supervising in the city and all that. And you had how many? 18. So is there a job that you are particularly looking at or that you could move up to?
The only person above me right now is the court administrator.
Okay, so.
Yes, I would love to be the court administrator.
But we never know these things, right? I mean, so tell me what that would require. Like in terms of what we've talked about, what would that require that you would have to change to get there?
Actually,
nothing.
You
can get into it now. So clearly what I'm hearing from you is that your brand, your reputation, your image, it's all in place. So clearly, it has to be because the way you work has led them to believe that you can do that work. So that goes back to performance. That goes back to brand and all of these different things. Well, you never know. In my life, the things that we least expect happen. I said I moved to Houston back in 1991, I think is when I moved to Houston, Texas. We had no plans. My husband, I had a home in Houston, in Miami, Florida when I married him. I sublet my home, or I leased it, and then we just got in the car, and I swear to God, this is a true story, just got in the car and started, I gave up, I was a lawyer, practicing lawyer, gave up my job, I was tired of doing it, I had been a litigator for about 6 or 7 years, and quite frankly, I was a little burned out. Got in the car and decided to drive, we went to Louisiana, we didn't think that was a place for us, and then we ended up in Houston. I came in the fall, had I been in the summer, I would never have moved to Houston, this is a true story, because I honestly was not bright enough to say, what is the summer like in Houston? I mean, honestly, that would have been a huge change. Had I arrived today when it's 110 degrees in Houston or 103, I would have said, no, I can't stay here. But I came in the fall. It was all lovely and wonderful. And I thought, wow, very cheap, right? Very, very affordable housing. It was great. Well, I mean, we moved there. And then about 7 years ago, I lost my husband. He didn't die. I've just lost him. I have no idea where the hell he's gone. So now I'm alone in Houston. Really, no family. I mean, I've got friends, but things happen is the point that I'm making. You've got to make the best of it because things do happen. So things might happen. Hopefully nothing bad for her, but things do happen. So stay on your track because you never know. All right, let's talk about educational opportunities to enhance your career. In your handout, I did a lot of research for you when I was doing this class because there's a whole lot that we can do. You've got the PowerPoint presentation on pages 1 through 4. And then beginning on page 5, we begin talking about educational opportunities and all the different things that you can do to enhance your career in the courthouse, which, of course, is transferable to any other courthouse or any other criminal activity in terms of employment that you may want to seek. And this is really, this speaks to everyone in the room. I don't know where you're at, and I don't really want to go into it, have you gone to college or not, but let me just suggest that it doesn't matter what you've done in your life because there's a whole lot that you can do if you want to do it. Certainly, more education is never going to hurt you. Never. Nobody will say that it's going to cost you money. It's going to be a sacrifice. It's going to be a commitment. But it's not going to hurt you. I guarantee you it's never going to hurt you. I would suggest that if you don't have a 4-year degree, and this is what you're thinking of doing, or an associate degree, I would suggest, and it's only a suggestion, that you look at the criminal justice degrees. And I'm saying that because you are working in the criminal justice environment. Now, I notice that you are level 1 or level 2. I can't say. Level two, well, that's a lot of work, because I've taught the levels, and I've taught level two. And that's a lot of learning that you have to do to get to a level two. So you're learning a lot about jurisdiction, right? You're learning about all sorts of legal, the American legal system, the Constitution of Texas. You're learning a whole lot about legal stuff to get to level two. Criminal justice degree will do that. A criminal justice degree will focus on legal classes as opposed to getting a degree in English, which is not a bad idea if that's what you want to do. A degree is a degree, but I'm suggesting to you that if this is the area where you want to stay, then a criminal justice degree might be a very apt thing to do. Because if you look at page 5, it tells you that basically criminal justice degrees, and you could go from an associate to a master to a 4-year degree, they really focus on the justice, on the judicial system, on the legal environment, as opposed to a degree in English or science, which is not really going to have that focus. And I think at this point in your life, that might be. So let's look at what a class, what a program of criminal justice would look like. And if you look at page 7, you notice that a bachelor's degree, and I'm just going through the different classes, so you get to feel what it would be like. This would be 120, this is a 4-year degree. But notice that a 4-year degree in criminal justice out of Sul Ross State University, you take at least 12 hours in criminal justice and 24 electives. And these are very interesting classes, many of which are very applicable to what you do. Because I know that we do a lot of stuff with juveniles in the municipal court, and some of that has increased in the last few years. Your judges are magistrates, and so you know they're issuing search warrants, right? They're issuing statutory warnings. They're doing examining trials. They're doing a number of things that, if you really understand what they're doing, it's going to be very helpful to you to move up later on to other higher positions, including being a judge. And so on pages A, we don't need to look at it here now, but what I've done is I've actually included what the descriptions of these classes would be to give you an insight of what a criminal justice degree would be, because I think that would be probably where you would be heading. Does anyone here have a criminal justice degree already? Is anybody thinking of doing anything else with education?
I have a bachelor's.
All right, so you don't have to necessarily, you've got your bachelor's, which is very useful, particularly for where you want to go. You don't need to double up on that, but you may be able to get a master's focusing in criminal justice or a certificate. Some universities just offer a year and a half on top of your master of your BA, which is going to be then, of course, on criminal justice. And that's what I'm saying, because your bachelor probably did not focus a whole lot on the legal system, did not focus a whole lot because that's not what you chose to do. But now you can just add. You can add layers to that to make it more applicable to you. What about you? Did you raise your hand? Well, if you already have a paralegal certificate, then you know that of course, focuses a whole lot, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that for those of you who don't have that. But certainly that paralegal certificate is also very useful and is a lot more malleable at this point in your life and much more feasible, because for some of you, you may not have a whole lot of time to do a 4-year degree at this point. You may not want to do that. It may be too much sacrifice and too much time involvement or money. So there are various things that we can do. On page 11, I've broken up the map of Texas so that you could actually see where you would be. And then we don't need to look at it now. I'm just walking you through what I've done for you. And then on pages 12 through 15, I actually list all the various schools. Because, of course, I teach this class 8 times a year, different regions of the state. The schools that might be available to you and the universities that without doing a whole lot of research, you might be able to figure out what those universities are and just, of course, apply and look them up. So that's been research that I've done for you and I've done for everyone that I've spoken to because it's useful, because a lot of what I find is that very often we have ideas about how to do things, but we don't really have a plan or we don't really know how to even access it. And it may be that by looking at these websites, you may get an idea of how long a program is, how much money, is there financial aid available. I mean, you need to do a little bit of research, but I've done a lot of it for you. On page 18... pages 18 through 20, I give you the list of all of the Texas criminal justice schools. And again, there are a variety of degrees that you can get in these different institutions, from an associate to a master's to a doctorate, depending where you are in life. So what you need to do is you need to find one. I was looking at one here in Odessa, the American Commercial College. They may just have, I don't know what they do, but there's a number of them in your area. or in the surrounding area for you to be able to at least explore the possibilities of what some of these might be. And then today we have a lot of wonderful things. So on page 21, we have something that really was not around when I went to college, and these are the online criminal justice schools. So if you cannot leave your home, if you have to do it at the house, if you can, if you just your responsibilities do not allow you to go to school, actually physically go somewhere, then you can do the online schools. And there are many reputable schools right here in Texas that might help you to get where you want to go in terms of a degree. So you need to look for reputation of the school, the program that they offer. And actually, I find that the online schools are almost more difficult in terms of the demand, because I know it's an online program. I know we have it at the paralegal school where I taught. It's a very recent thing. It's very demanding in terms of the work that you have to turn in and the homework that you have to do to be able to qualify. Has anybody done an online program here? Okay, great. So tell me again, which one did you do?
Well, I didn't do one here, but before I got my bachelor's degree, it was pretty much all distance because I was already in the military, so we went everywhere. And you dedicate a lot of time because you don't have an instructor that you can say, okay, now what is this thing? I mean, you have your instructor, but it's all via email.
Right.
So you don't have somebody that simplifies it for you and gives you all the notes and everything right there. You have to do it online.
You have structured guidance, but you're doing a whole lot of work. So you would recommend an online school? Discipline. But, you know, you'll be surprised on how many different types of online schools they have. I mean, I like writing, and there's this wonderful online program in New York, which has nothing to do with legal stuff, and it's all writing, poetry, and nonfiction, and it's not that expensive, and it's really pretty demanding. You have to submit all these documents, then people give you feedback. You have to give feedback to other people. I mean, they have created a number of different options on online systems that are very valuable. What about you? What did you do? Did you do your paralegal online? But very convenient not having to sit there 4 hours a night, and then you're at home in your pajamas, whatever you want to do. So the point that I'm making is that there's no reason for anyone here who wants to do something else with their lives not to do it. There's none. Because you have online schools available, which were not around 15, 10 years ago. Now we have them, and some of them are quite good, and they're getting very good at it. And some of them, of course, even have it where you actually do see the instructor talk to you, and you use the webcams and all that. So they're getting really quite very sophisticated. On page 23, paralegals. I think a paralegal program is another option for those of you who want to get somewhat of a legal education without having to put the investment of a four-year or a two-year program. Now, paralegal programs can be, in some instances, a two-year program, but they don't have to be. Paralegal, it really trains you to work with lawyers, but of course trains you to work with court staff as well. The prosecutor's office where I worked in the city of Houston hired a lot of paralegals to work in that office, and they would be drafting pleadings and working with research, I mean, doing a whole lot of legal work. And so a paralegal program, for example, could be an associate degree, which is really the two-year program, or a certificate. They have a variety of different programs available, and as I said, very feasible, because for somebody who wants to learn about the law and who wants to show a potential employer that you've done something else in terms of your studies, the paralegal program does work. And I know that one of you is a paralegal. Has that helped you at the courthouse at all?
Not really a whole lot.
Not really a whole lot. So what do you think you want to do? Okay, well, see, and that's great, because that's what we're talking about here. If you want to get somewhat of a legal education and you cannot afford the four-year, or you just want to do a certificate, or you already have the four-year degree, because a paralegal certificate is very effective when added to a four-year degree, because it's all law. It's all legally related. I mean, if you look at page 23, you will notice that all the courses are legal courses. You have the Introduction to Law and Ethics, Criminal Law. You do have English, but, of course, that's very related to the law. Legal Research, the American. I mean, you can read it on your own, but all of this is really very legally related, and it may be something that you may want to add. Any questions about that? No? All right, so on page 25, I wanted to show you that paralegal certificates can be obtained both in paralegal schools, which do only that, or they can actually be obtained in universities. A lot of universities now have something called legal assistance degree. Legal assistant and paralegal is really the same thing. People use the term interchangeably. You're either a paralegal or a legal assistant, but it's the same thing. And let me tell you that in Texas, the paralegal profession is a very active and very well-recognized profession. So much that the State Bar of Texas has a legal assistance division. How many of you knew that? So if you're a legal assistant, you may want to go into the State Bar of Texas and become a member, because then you get to network a whole lot. And of course, being a legal assistant could help you not only in the court system, but maybe later working with a criminal defense attorney, who of course wants the experience that you've gained in a courthouse. Because imagine how useful you are to a criminal defense attorney who does a whole lot of municipal court work if you have been a clerk at that courthouse. Imagine how useful you will be to that person because you have been on the other side. And so you want to think about all these things because, as I said, you don't need to stay where you are unless, you know, unless you want to, but there's many possibilities. Yes, ma'am. The State Bar of Texas. The State Bar of Texas, which licenses all of the attorneys practicing in Texas, the State Bar of Texas has a legal assistant division. If you just go and Google it, you will see how involved that is. They have annual meetings, and of course they have paralegals all throughout Texas, so there probably is a local legal assistance division right here in Odessa and Midland and whatever towns you live in, so look for that. But they have annual workshops, they have conferences, you know, very exciting, that area of law. Paralegals can make a lot of money, guys. They can make a lot of money. So particularly, you can transfer a lot of your skills, and if you join it with the paralegal profession, you may do much, a lot better than you may think you will. So a lot of the universities are now offering paralegal degrees or legal assistant certificates or legal assistant degrees. And if you notice on page 25, Stephen Austin State University has a degree that is only 34 hours. And you graduate, of course, with a certificate. And as I said, the paralegal degree, if you already have your bachelor, can be added on top of the bachelor. And it's just and a certificate that can be very useful. And I've given you all the different things that you would take in that class to give you an insight to what that would entail. Because, of course, this is different from your typical college degree. On page 29, a lot of paralegal programs throughout the state of Texas. Now, the difference is that there are some schools that do nothing but paralegal programs, and now universities, which have all kinds of programs, are also incorporating the paralegal degree. But a paralegal program would be one where that's all the school does. And I don't know whether there are any here. I know Dallas has them. I know we have a huge one, which is the one I teach at, which is the very top Center for Advanced Legal Studies. And there you can get an associate degree or a paralegal certificate. And that's the one that I told you was from 6 to 10, 4 nights a week. But now they're combining it with an online program, so students only have to go one night a week. So they're making it a lot more accessible for students to attend these particular schools. So a paralegal program is something you may want to think about. It's just a thought. If you don't want to do the four-year degree, it's just one more option. And then I want to talk, any questions about that? And of course, on page 30, the list of the online paralegal programs. You either go physically to the school, or you do a combination, or you do it all online. And again, stuff, these are resume enhancements. These are things that will help your career, if not today, 5 years from now. At some point, it's not going to hurt you. It's never going to hurt you to have more education on your resume than less. It's never going to hurt. You may not use all of it, but certainly it's impressive when someone is evaluating your resume and looking at your at you as a candidate. All right, any questions about that? No? All right, then we have on page 31, and this is also a very exciting program. This is an online program out of, I believe, it's University of Michigan. And this is a judicial administration program. This is now for someone who is definitely going to stay in the court system, who wants to get a whole lot better at what they do, and who wants to take pretty serious courses that deal only and solely with judicial administration. And let me just say to you that a lot of your towns can pay for this, and we'll talk about that a little later. But don't assume that this has to be all out of pocket, because a lot of towns and cities do have in their budget educational opportunities for their staff, but you have to ask about it. And you have to, if you're in a small place, talk to your judges about it. For example, on page 31, this program out of Michigan offers a number. Let's look at their mission, because this is important, because this is now a totally different track. This is for someone who's already pretty high up in the corporate, in the ladder of, in the judicial ladder, and who wants to really improve in certain areas to become ultimately a manager, a clerk of the court. So it's, this is really a very different program. This is to extend academic rigor and standing to judicial administration, stimulate and support performance, and elevate the presence and respect of the judicial system for the graduates that they serve. And if you look at, on page, the non-credit, they have different, so they have different programs. They have a non-credit certificate, which is outlined on page 31. And if you notice, the non-credit program, you have to get 60 contact hours online. And those hours would include things like case flow management, technology, information technology management, human resources management, leadership, purpose and response. Do you see what I'm saying? So this is not just a paralegal degree. This is a very, very structured degree for someone who is in the judicial system, who is going to stay there, who needs to get better at a lot of these. How many of you deal with information technology? That's a whole different world right now. Case flow management, I mean, that's very important. You can make a lot of changes in your courthouse if you really have these expertise. And so these are not that expensive, and you do them over time. You don't, at 60 credits, you don't do them in one sitting. I think they have like 3 or 4 years for you to go through all of these different classes. Very interesting. They have leadership. They have education and training and development, so that will be for those of you who are already supervising to bring and incorporate these ideas in your own court system. Essential components of the courts, visioning and strategic planning. So this is really for either, it could be a judge or it could be you, working to try to improve the court system. And of course you're going to look very bright if you say to a judge, this is what I want to do. And again, we look at these as resume enhancements, which means that when somebody's evaluating you, they are impressed. They're impressed by the fact that you have a non-credit degree from the University of Michigan online, and then you include all the competencies that you've taken in your resume, and of course that is very impressive. They have a credit-bearing certificate that's a little bit more expensive. Actually, it's a lot more expensive, but keep in mind that these are not done overnight. These are done over a period of years, and so you may or may not have the money in your budget to do that. And we'll talk about financial things that will help you later on, because there's things out there that you can do. Then they also have a master's degree. Had you guys heard about this program out of Michigan State University? You may want to Google it and really go into the wonderful website. I've given you all the information. And very specialized, and you can call them and they'll tell you, they can tailor a program for you. If you have now been moved into a certain position and you don't have a lot of information on caseflow, but you need to get that information, you know, we help you a lot with the Texas Municipal Courts Education Center, but these classes are not as much in depth as, you know, you may need for your specific job. These are great courses, and they do touch upon all the things that you guys might need to do your job better, but this is really very specified and very, very focused. And so you may want to think about that. So you can email them or speak to them and just get more information about that. And on page 234 and 35, again, this is the credit-bearing certificate at the same university, which actually I've outlined for you all the different things that you would have to take to be able to pass these courses and really to be able to be competent in these courses. So I think they're very interesting. I'll leave you with that. Then I want to talk to you on page 36, the National Center for State Courts. How many of you have taken any of their courses? The National Center for State Courts. This is a national association which offers a lot of classes for individuals involved in a judicial system. And if you notice, they have a range of professional development programs. A lot of them, again, are maybe online. Some of them, they actually offer workshops. They also have all kinds of different things in terms of manuals. When I was at the courthouse, I bought a number of manuals from them because these are training manuals. I mean, you guys are, those of you who are supervisors, you know, you have to train. You have to train people with respect to dealing with difficult people, with this respect to how to handle the case flow. There's a lot of training that you have to do, and a lot of these manuals have built-in PowerPoint slides to help you build in your own training. So there's a whole lot that you can do if you're at that level already, or you can build it up for later. They have a court management program, and they have a court executive development program. So very exciting possibilities for individuals in the court system. And if you notice under the court management program, they talk about the kind of things that would be available to you and how you can do a whole lot of this on the web. On page 37, you notice that they have live in-person classes, which I think if your counties have money available for that, I think you should try to use it. There's a lot of wonderful seminars that are offered nationally for court management issues, leadership, IT, all kinds of security, all kinds of different things. You should try to go to some of those if you can. But they also have, of course, e-learning, which is online. And these are not that expensive. These are web CT learnings and very affordable, and a lot of very interesting topics that apply to all of the courthouses throughout the United States. They do a lot of studies in terms of what are the recurring themes in the municipal courts as opposed to the Supreme Courts, for example. And so they know the kinds of things that we deal with at the municipal courts. And then, for example, I wanted to show you on page 38, and just take a look at the kinds of things that they have ongoing right now. This is, of course, about maybe 8 or 9 months old, so they may have changed them. But would it help you to have something on revenue enhancement? Introduction to case flow. Notice they're not that expensive. But you wouldn't have to pay for them. I'm thinking that your county should pay for it, your court should pay for it. Fundamental issues of case flow management, presenting court data. Reduction, delay in metropolitan courts. This is for the large courts. These are in-person and, of course, e-learning, court performance, standard. As I said, when you take these classes online, they give you a lot of materials for you to take with you. You can download PowerPoints. They have videos. They're very exciting classes, and they allow you to take them at your own pace. So, for example, you know how that works. You sign up for it, and then you have maybe a number of months to take the class. You can repeat it as many times as you want. You can download the PowerPoint. This is stuff that you can then take to your courthouses and implement. And so it's not a whole lot of investment for something that is going to be long-lasting. And we want to be viewed as good trainers. We want to be viewed as people who have all these wonderful ideas. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. It's all out there for you. If you notice on page 39, I wanted just to show you the kinds of publications that the National Association for Court Management has. Again, bring this to the attention of your judges. These are wonderful manuals. They're put together by experts in the field, lawyers, professors, judges. So these are really well done. And if you notice, the mini guide publications, business community management, community creativity, core competency, developing comprehensive public information programs for the courts. What does that mean? That means that your particular court would create brochures and a marketing to let people know. I mean, how many of you do that? How many of you have a website which folks can go to, which is pretty educational? How many of you, for example, have thought of having a brochure somewhere in your court system that advises the defendants who are coming, because, you know, nobody reads their tickets, that advises them of the options that they can take? These are very, very instrumental stuff. We were thinking at the City of Houston when I was there of having kiosks where people can actually come in and sit down before they actually go to the courtroom, and videos of what's going to happen in court, what's an arraignment. Because the more you do for the public, and a lot of it doesn't take that much work, honestly, the more you do for the public, the better you're going to be perceived. So maybe you can tell your judge, well, what about if we do a brochure so that people who come in, they can be given the brochure to sit in the courtroom and read up on it while they're doing that. Even if it's you don't have the money, well, then do one laminated sheet. They have to return it, but they can read. Do you all follow what I'm saying? These things are important. And so this will give you the tools to do that, and they may even give you the ideas. Holding courts accountable, they even have classes on security. A lot of the small courts don't have the budgets, but really need to know how to secure the place better in terms of, you know, metal detectors, can they afford? And the National State Court Management Office offers a lot of information to help you. I wanted to show you on page 40 the kinds of conferences that they offer. Now, some of these have already passed, but all you have to do is look at, you know, go Google them and you'll find it. But look at 2009. The purposes and responsibilities of the courts. Now, this is an expense. It's not that expensive, but yeah, you have to pay for the seminar, and it's in Oregon. But again, approach your judges and say, look, I'd like to go to some of these. Is there any money in the budget? Can we ask the city to put some money so that we can do some of this? It's not a bad idea, folks. There's a whole lot out there. The July conference, of course, hasn't occurred yet. It's going to be next week. This is in Boston, the human side of court management. Do you think that's important for us, the human side of court management? What do you think they're going to talk about? What are they going to deal with, the human side of court management? Dealing with difficult people, diversity, right? Issues of diversity, a huge issue. Because we, culturally, we don't get it. And we make mistakes with the way we deal with different ethnic groups. Judges have to have diversity teaching. I can tell you that. I know that for a fact because I taught them for quite a long time, about 3 years ago. Judges need to know what to say or not to say. You know, the subtle stereotyping, the subtle racial things that we may say on the court that we're not even conscious that we're doing. So that's probably a very exciting seminar. How wonderful if you were able to do that. 2010, tell your judges, this is coming up next year, court space, security, and emergency planning. If there's any money in the budget, go to these things. What are you going to walk away when you leave, do you think? Huge training manuals, PowerPoint presentations, all kinds of tools to then help you go from there to improve the court systems that you are in. I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but clearly they have a lot of information here. And then in my last page, page 41, I have a lot of websites that I am guiding you to go to because I think they might be very helpful. And the last thing I want to share with you is financial aid. There are a number of groups out there, particularly for women, but there's probably for men too, but a lot of groups for women that give awards and grants and all kinds of stuff. And all you have to do is write personal statements, explain why you want to go to a particular class, and they will give you the money to do it. So this is for not only college or a master's degree, whatever you're pursuing. This is also for individuals who may want to attend like the Michigan State University, which is a $5,000 deal. So the websites are in the front, but if you look at page in the back, page 2, the Possible Woman Foundation. I just want to show you the stuff that's available because when I teach these seminars, I find that people go, heck, I didn't know anything about this. There's a lot of money out there, folks. We just have to find it, but there's a lot of money out there. The Possible Woman Foundation, it gives scholarships for women who are returning to school, changing careers, seeking advancement, and so on and so on. Of course, this is dated. Doesn't mean that it's not. You could just Google and update it. I just did it in 2008. You can get between $2,000 to $5,000. So let's say that you want to take the Michigan State University class. This is really what you want to do, and it's $5,000. Then write a wonderful personal statement and explain why it is that you really need to do this, why you don't have any money, why you want to move up. You just have to do a good statement, a good application. And if you need help with that, email me. I'm at Thurgood Marshall School of Law in Houston. You can email me. I'd be happy to help you. But there is money out there. You just have to tell them why you want to do it. The Project Working Mom Scholarship, and again, I apologize to the gentleman in the room. A lot of these are for women, but I'm sure there's for men as well. This also gives you a full ride scholarship on one of the following schools. Now, this one may be a little bit more selective of the schools. Again, all of these require you to write something and say why you want to do it. But look at the Jeanette Rankin Foundation. This one gives money to women of low income, ages 35 and older. And by low income, they mean somebody who doesn't have to be, you may not think of yourself as low income, but they're talking about somebody who's not making enough money to finance an education. So you might be eligible. And they have to be enrolled or accepted, not only enrolled, accepted to an accredited school. And then they have a lot of money that they have available. And then finally, Talbot. This is the clothing manufacturer company. They have a charitable foundation, and they give awards to women. 5 women will receive $10,000. 50 will receive $1,000. Well, that will cover one of the seminars, the $1,000 scholarships. It's a matter of writing a very compelling statement as to why it is that you want to do this. And if you work at the court system and you want to do the Michigan State, for example, you explain, I am a mom, I have raised 3 children, I am in the court system, I really am looking to become a judge because in my city I can do that without being a lawyer, but I want to have this on my resume. I mean, you just have to write the compelling statement. I hope this has helped. It's really a very informational workshop about all the different things that we can do. So I'd like to leave you with a poem. I always do this because I like to believe that we can change our lives and that, again, there's always room for change. This is a poem by a woman by the name of Donna Markova. I don't know whether you've ever heard of her. She's written a very good book. And she says the following, and I think it applies to everyone. I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. That's the most beautiful language, right? Your heart becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance. This means go out there. Do something else with your life if you want to. Don't be afraid. Risk it. Do it. To live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on to the next as fruit. It's a very optimistic poem about our lives and what we can do with them. I hope you do great things. I'm sure you're already doing them, but I hope you do even better things in your life. And I hope this has helped, and I hope you have a good seminar for the balance of the class. Thank you.